So once again, good morning, grace and peace to each one of you. It is always a gift to have our brothers and sisters from Roanoke Mennonite Church with us in worship. I love when our congregations come together and do things, partner together in the ways that we do through VBS, hymn sings, special services like Ash Wednesday, Maundy Thursday, and most recently some junior high and high school activity together as well. We at Metamora Mennonite Church are encouraged by the Lord's work in your body, in your congregation, and we say welcome this morning. And if the sermon isn't too long, we can say let's eat sooner or later, okay? So we'll get there. So to our friends from Roanoke Mennonite Church, again, welcome. And we also extend a warm welcome to those visiting with us today as well. For we come from many places, many backgrounds, many experiences, and we come together today to center ourselves around the person of Jesus, who we worship together in spirit and in truth. And this is Christ the King Sunday. For those who follow the church calendar, this is the last Sunday of the church calendar before it begins again in Advent for next Sunday, which means it's like New Year's Eve. We should have a party downstairs after church. So that's what we'll do, Christ the King Sunday. This past fall here at Metamora Mennonite Church, we have been in a series called Roots, okay? This series has been about looking back deep into the corridors of history, deep into our Anabaptist Mennonite heritage, and rediscovering or discovering for the first time some of the gifts of these radical reformers from the 16th century. This has been our series called Roots. Today is our final week for Roots, because next week we do begin Advent, and Advent is our series would be called Restoration is Near. So a bit of a recap, because indeed it has been a very rich series here at Metamora Mennonites. We have centered on Jesus and what radical discipleship means and looks like in the Christian faith. We have centered on Jesus and the scriptures and how we approach the sacred text as Anabaptists. We have considered Christian community as the center of our lives and how our vertical relationship with God affects our horizontal relationship with others in the world. Last week, we had the blessing of having Michael Danner share a sermon on community and discernment practices of the Anabaptists. We have learned about reconciliation as the center of our work as we intentionally work towards peace building, any sort of peace building efforts in places where there is brokenness and chaos. And that Sunday, we worshiped together with our brothers and sisters at Zion Baptist Church in Peoria. The blessings continued with our All Saints Worship Communion Breakfast downstairs a few weeks ago, celebrating the great saints whose shoulders we stand on today, who have before us modeled what a life committed to Christ looks like. And we had a week that we considered the life and teachings of Menno Simons, and a fun Sunday where we considered the Anabaptist Mennonite practice of simplicity. Okay? Simplicity. Now, one of the things about simplicity, an outworking of that, was to put forth a community of goods, earthly goods, which are freely offered to each other in the church. And here's my list of earthly goods that I can provide the church, okay? So I've got a chainsaw, a power washer, a lawnmower, various assortment of tools, so on and so forth, a daughter who likes to babysit, a son who mows lawns. We have an old swing set that we just want to get rid of. Anyone can just take that. Community of earthly goods, you're welcome. You can take it. Our dog Champ, I don't know. If you're having a bad day, cuddle time with Champ. It's about this big, okay? So that's Champ. Board games, lots of board games at our house. And some skills of painting, flooring, tree removal, and landscaping. Oh, yeah, and lots of dad jokes. Do you guys want to hear one? Did you know the oldest computer that's ever been owned was owned by Adam and Eve? Yes, it was an Apple. it's not even the punchline yet. It was an Apple with very limited memory. Just one bite and everything crashed. Come on. Let's go eat. No. All right. So throughout this series, many of the weeks, we have spoke on, shared about the wonderful, great, rich heritage of this Anabaptist movement, this radical, say it with me, radical wing of the Reformation. We have spoken and shared about how this movement has been a gift to many. And if you've been around for this series, you may be thinking, my, don't these Anabaptists think a little too highly of themselves? Because we've been talking about the rich, amazing history and heritage of the Anabaptists, because that's been our focus. But today, before we get to our text of salt and light, salt, you over here? Can I hear you? Salt? Yeah, a little shake. And then light, I don't know what we do. Just hold it up. There we go. We can pass out some matches later, I guess. I don't know. Before we get to that text, I do want to name some of the ways that the Anabaptists have fallen short. Maybe some of the ways that we have dropped the ball, missed the mark, and have been less than the ideal reflection of what God is in the world. So we receive these criticisms in humility as we continue to hold on to that which is worthy of bringing forward today and into the future. So borrowing from this book, The Naked Anabaptist from Stuart Murray, first, with a movement that is so focused on discipleship, so laser-focused on discipleship and laser-sharp focus on the scriptures, the Anabaptists then can easily find themselves slipping into what we call biblical literalism and legalism. This can happen in some Anabaptist Mennonite context, so much so that the other reformers of the 16th century accused the Anabaptists of works righteousness because of this. And because when discipleship slips into cultural conservatism, and ethics are valued over spirituality, then our discipleship may not have much to do with grace. It's area number one. Second, like many other denominations that exist today, even the Anabaptists are guilty of biblical selectivity. What does this mean? Well, it means we pay attention to what we want to pay attention to when it comes to the scriptures, right? Most Sundays, even here at Metamore Mennonites, you will listen to a message from the Gospels. Sometimes we venture into the Old Testament, and we sprinkle a little Paul and the other epistles in there once in a blue moon. Also in our selectivity, when we consider the Gospels, the healing ministry of Jesus is not been an emphasis of the Anabaptist Mennonites. We're really keen on the ethical teachings of Jesus, but we lack perhaps some engagement in the miracles or the charismatic realities of the Spirit that are plainly written about. Another area is the Anabaptists were one of the first movements to truly believe that everyone, not just clergy, by means of the Holy Spirit, has the ability to both read and interpret the Bible. This is good, amen? This is a good thing? Well, if everyone can do that, right, and there isn't an authority from a thoroughly equipped or studied pastor to tell you what it means, then there tends to be many interpretations of the text. And this can create what? Division. This can create division. Even if read in community, it can still create division. One way this division takes on flesh is the practice of banning or shunning. Banning headstrong, non-compliant, stubborn members, dissenting members, church members in history have found themselves excluded for having a different understanding or interpretation of the text. Division. I feel it. Another example of a shortcoming, perhaps, for the 16th century Anabaptists, okay, and what I'm going to share is not actually the shortcoming yet, but the 16th century Anabaptists were passionate, say it with me, passionate, about sharing their faith. They were passionate about sharing their faith, all right, with all people. This passion in evangelism brought concern to those who were trying to maintain the status quo, so that many Anabaptists were put to death for talking about their Jesus. Felix Manns. Anyone know the name Felix Manns? I knew Mike would, or Mike Yoder, some others. Felix Manns was the first of many who died because he would not promise to keep quiet about his faith. In 1526, a council in Zurich had passed an edict that made adult rebaptism punishable by drowning. January 5th of the following year, Felix Manns, became the first casualty of that new law and the first Swiss Anabaptist to be martyred at the hands of these domineering Protestants. Now, to the negative, as a result of this early persecution of the Anabaptists, over the years, one of the survival mechanisms by certain groups was to become separatists. Separatists. That is, to remove themselves from society, to come away for the maintenance and survival of their families and their church communities, to come out and be separate. With a higher value placed on holiness, therefore we need to withdraw from the wider society and anything in the culture that would poison or corrupt or contaminate their communities. And they become, as a result, the quiet in the land. The quiet in the land. And this practice, in many areas, is still embedded into the ethos of many Mennonite North American churches, even today. Though this nonverbal, non-engaging approach to bearing witness to Jesus is deficient in a post-Christendom culture that knows very little about what Christians actually believe. And finally, we could take a look at examples of the city of Munster from the 16th century, or the serious lack of sustained and ongoing engagement in the civil rights movement. The point is, Anabaptist Mennonites have not always gotten it right. We just need to name that. We just need to state that we haven't arrived as an Anabaptist movement. We have not arrived as a Mennonite denomination. We have not arrived as a collective of Christ followers, nor as individuals. Our journey into a greater and greater Christ-likeness is just that, a Spirit-guided journey. So may the Lord's grace be with us all. Well, today we have this text to bring us maybe hopefully back to center. It's about identity and mission. As we conclude this Roots series, we have a text from the Sermon on the Mount. It is a life-giving text. It is an identity-naming text. It is a mission-empowering text. It is also a text that contemporary Anabaptists take very, very seriously, for it expands our call to discipleship. So it was read earlier today, but I want to read it another time here. Salt and light. And so we have you guys remember these from like back in the day? This one needs to be greased or something. It's a little, maybe I'll go this way. Oh, there we go. That's a little better. So, you are the salt of the earth. But if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled on underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. This passage follows the Beatitudes, where Jesus has just finished describing who the blessed are. And then he finishes with the reality of, hey, there's going to be persecution for the faithful. Now, Jesus here is describing their calling in the world. One thing about this text that I see is this. It's the use of this phrase, you are. Found nowhere else in the Gospels. You are. You are. I love this. For at its core, it's dealing with not only our identity, but somehow mysteriously at the same time, our mission. You are salt, and you are light. Jesus is naming his hearers. He's naming who they are. So let's just pause here for a moment. Let's just pause right here. And let's just imagine that Jesus were to come through the doors back there and down the row here. I mean, Jesus is already here, but just embodied Jesus. Let's just play. Jesus walks in, and he comes over, and he says, Mark, you are... What would be the next words out of his mouth?
You are the light of the world.
Okay. You are light. Okay. All right. And Jesus comes down and he walks in and he says, Andrew, you are, what would he say? Salt. Okay. We have light and salt. Those two are taken. And he walks in. And he turns to Dustin. Everyone's like, Dustin. And Jesus says, Dustin, you are here. I like that. You are here. Yeah, and Mike. Jesus comes in and he says to you, you are. Brother? I like that. It's good. You are salt, you are light, you are here, you are a brother. It's fun to ponder, isn't it? I don't know about you, but there have been times in my life where I don't feel or accept that reality. It's not salt and light. Sometimes I feel a different voice altogether, and it says, you are a failure. You are a disappointment. You are not as smart as you think you are. You are a sinner. I gotta say that that's not Jesus. Because that would be in contrast to what we just read. That's not Jesus. That's the accuser. That's the accuser. So, Jesus today is reminding us, reminding myself, reminding us that we are not those things. But he's reminding us of our true identity, our true calling. This you are gives us vocation within Jesus' community. It gives us vocation. The you are statements of Matthew 5, I recall a similar type of pronouncement from 1 Peter. Now this is Peter talking. It says, but you are choice race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his what? Marvelous light. These declarations perform, I think, at least two functions. I think they assure us, on the one hand, that we are somebody in God's plan, in humility, but we're somebody in God's plan. And they also remind us of that our identity is linked to our mission. Our identity is linked to our mission. Salt back then, as today, was used in a number of ways. It can be used as a seasoning. It could be used as a preservative. Salt can be used as a purifying agent. These days, salt is used to de-ice the roads, okay, in the walkways. And salt is also used in a ring for sumo wrestlers. How about that? Salt is in the middle of that ring. Okay, that's fun. Now, we don't know what use Jesus had in mind exactly, but Jesus is warning that salt, whatever its use, can fail if it doesn't do what it was intended to do. Therefore, it becomes useless and then thrown out. Jesus is saying, pay attention to your mission. Jesus is saying, pay attention to your purpose in the world. Now, this flies in the face of separatism or being quiet in the land now, doesn't it? I think the point is that if followers of Jesus lose their aliveness in Christ, their excitement in their relationship with Jesus, this will negatively affect their relationships with the world around them. I love the Message translation of this passage. It says, let me tell you why you are here. Eugene Peterson in this translation says, you're here to be salt seasoning that what? That brings out God flavors of this earth. You ever had fries that are unsalted? Yuck. You ever had fries that are salted too much? Also, yuck. Also, yuck. I just love this God flavors, bringing out the God flavors of this earth, because God is everywhere. So wherever we are, wherever you are, we are invited to showing the world what God's reign, what God's kingdom actually tastes like. This begs the question for our congregations, how is our salt seasoning in our neighborhoods and in our workplaces going? How's it going? Too much salt, which is not good. Not enough salt. Are we seasoning? Are we bringing that salt into the world? So next we move to light. Ever consider the purpose of light? What's the purpose? Hey, light, what's your purpose right now? What are you doing? Why does light exist? Well, Matthew, in this gospel, he emphasizes that it is the nature of light to be seen, the nature of light to be visible. Kids, this is why we turn off the lights when we leave our rooms or the house, because it ceases to be seen by anybody if no one's in that room. So you could say turning off the lights is biblical. Turn off those lights, kids, because it's not going to be seen by anyone. And don't tell me the dog cares. Okay, right? Lights go on lampstands. Lights from a city on a hill can be seen for miles and miles. This light-bearing role for followers of Jesus is connected to the light images that are used for Israel in the Old Testament. Israel's call is to be a what to the nations? Light to the nations. It's also connected to Jesus' role of bringing light to the Gentiles. The people living in darkness in Matthew 4 have seen a great light. Then in verse 16, in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. So if we are the light of the world, and if that light is to be seen, friends, after lunch today, we have to leave. We can't stay here. We can't stay here. Our light is to shine in ways that evoke praise of the one who has called us. Well, how is this done? Well, the Anabaptists sort of major on this, okay? All right? Anabaptists, right? So they may see your good deeds. This is what we do, right? We're comfortable with this idea, to do good works, to do good things, to act in such a way that will glorify your Father in heaven. Though later we learn that this light-bearing mission includes witness with the use of words as well. Because in Matthew 10, when Jesus sends out the 12, he says the following, what I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What is whispered in your ear, proclaim from the roofs. And later in that same story, whoever acknowledges me before others, I will also acknowledge them before my Father in heaven. Works, deeds alone, perhaps not enough. Our call also is to share in words. So in our second week of this Roots series, I had about four people stand up and read an excerpt from a book. They were personal stories of people who have stumbled upon this Anabaptist movement, yet deeply resonate with this Anabaptist theology. They were stories of people who were not what they call cradle Mennonites. They were not people who had the right last name. And they were not raised in any sort of Anabaptist tradition. For we are many, myself included. And to bring a close to the sermon here this morning, I would like to read a passage from that same book, this one from an Anabaptist, though not a Mennonite, in Minnesota named Greg Boyd. He shares more on what he is noticing in regards to these people seeking to follow Jesus radically with their lives. Greg Boyd says the following in the book: what many who are being caught up in this Anabaptist movement lack is a sense of tribal identity and historical rooting. And many are looking for this. A central feature of postmodernity is the longing to live in a story that is bigger than oneself. Many, therefore, are looking for a tradition that they can align with. The only tradition that embodies what this rising breed of kingdom radicals is looking for is the Anabaptist tradition. This is the only tradition that consistently refused political power and violence. This is the only tradition that made humble, self-sacrificing love the centerpiece of what it means to follow Jesus. It's the only tradition that isn't soaked in the blood, and the only tradition that looks remotely like Jesus. This tradition is a treasure to be cherished. And it's a tradition whose time may have come. For this is precisely the vision of the kingdom that millions today are waking up to. Myself included. So we have our identity as Christ followers, as followers of Jesus. We are salt and light. This is our mission. And we as Anabaptist Mennonites have this heritage. So where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? Well, we have some options. We can choose to do nothing with this heritage. We can reject our heritage altogether, discounting it as meaningless and irrelevant in our day and age. Or we can take this heritage and have our frustration of the sad state of the church in general in America. And we can focus on some period of the past, view that as the golden age, and spend our time reminiscing of the days of old. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could return to those days? Wouldn't it be wonderful if that balcony was full like it used to be? Anyone stuck there? Or perhaps we can take our heritage of faith, our history, hold on to that which is good, and leave behind the traditions that simply don't work anymore. Forge a new path forward together. In reflecting on and learning from our roots, which we've done this past fall, we learn to understand ourselves better, and we become more able to discern where we are going as individuals and as a church. Instead of starting over, we can say, we begin where we are. We begin where we are. By accepting our heritage, we become free to change, adapt, shift, and relate in new ways to the desperate needs of the world around us. So, I saw on Instagram post that they're now calculating that there are 8 billion people in the world. We just crossed that 8 billion mark. And we're gonna need a lot of salt. Just a lot of salt. And we're gonna need a vacuum cleaner. We're gonna need a lot of salt. So maybe we, as salt and light here and now, near the end of 2022, we can testify in word and deed to the love, grace, and mercy, and faithfulness of Jesus. Now, why did I pass out salt and light before the sermon? We're going to take the next few minutes. And salt, folks, are you with me? Salt, over here. Light folks, are you here? Yeah, okay, it's good, I like it. I think they're a little more excited. It's okay. Salt, find a light. Light, find some salt. We're gonna take 3 minutes, 4 minutes here, and you're gonna do your own application. And there's some questions on the board, on the screen, the walls, not screens. Right here. And find someone, maybe you know them, maybe you don't know them, and introduce yourself. Say, how am I going to seek, by God's grace, and God's strength, and God's power, to be salt and light in the world? Go ahead, 3 or 4 minutes. Yeah. Okay, church. Is it too short? Longer? Longer? What is this? All right. Well, thank you. It's good. Hey, Avery. All right, church, I knew it was going to be hard, so here we go. Salt and light. Thank you. Thank you. We're going to continue on with our worship here. I do have one quick thing that I'll save for the announcement time. So, all right. I think we're still sharing. Maybe they're doing lots of things this week, not just one. And yeah, salt and light, heading into Thanksgiving with family. You're welcome. No, it's great. We love our families, right? So, that's good. So we'll continue on in worship this morning with prayer and sharing with John. Thank you.
I told one of my conversation partners that I'm going to be on my best behavior at Thanksgiving meal. So, one way to, one way to be salt and light also is to be thankful, is to give thanks. So we'll give you an opportunity in a minute. About 100 years after Anabaptist Felix Mons, another group of pilgrims on a journey. These were also separatists who separated from the Church of England. In the fall of 1620, landed in Cape Cod area of Massachusetts. And during the first winter, about half of them died because of disease and starvation. But then the following fall, they had a crop, and they got together and set aside 3 days for Thanksgiving. And that tradition has really stuck. During President Roosevelt's administration, it was finally set on the fourth Thursday of November. It's my favorite holiday. I think it's the time of year. It's an ecumenical holiday, isn't it? Everyone can participate. So Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians to give thanks in all circumstances, in all situations, maybe even in difficult situations, to be able to give thanks. So I'm going to give brief opportunity to share. And Eric's preaching text today, this "you are" is plural. So this is giving thanks as a community, giving thanks together.